Good morning, Senate Tax Committee. We'll come to order. I'm sorry I was late this morning. We were looking for somebody to convene on my behalf this morning, and it was a challenge this morning. I guess we are the first ones here this morning. So good morning to everyone. I'm sorry to keep you all waiting. Eric Nauman is here for round three of our education finance course, and I'm excited to have you come back, Mr. Nauman. I learn something new, a lot new, every time you come. So thank you so much.
Well, Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Eric Nauman with the Office of Senate Counsel, Fiscal Policy and Research. And it's always a pleasure to come back. I know this will feel a tad disjointed because we're jumping in the middle of a briefing, so I thought what I would do is kind of do a quick what we've done and where we're headed. Members have the packet from last time in front of them. But we also have a supplement. There was a request for some testing data, some performance measures, the NAEP test, the National Assessment of Education Progress, as well as some testing data and graduation rates. Madam Chair, it had not been my intent to go into that in great detail at all, in fact, but we will put it on the web as part of this briefing, and so members can have access to it, and we've prepared copies. So unless you have questions about that, it would be not my intent to go through
that. And Mr. Nauman, I appreciate that. I'm grateful that others are interested in this subject, too, but I think when it comes to testing scores and graduation rates and things like that, that's a little beyond the scope of this committee, but I'm grateful for the information.
I thought so as well, but we're always happy to have the questions. So what we began with was the Constitution. We did some trends, some basic terms, and then we crawled into the education aids budget. And we're just beginning to get into the property tax discussion next time, or last time, and I think we stopped right where we had the conversation about the so-called big plan that was Governor Ventura's initiative to eliminate the general education levy. What lies ahead of us is some of the overall E-12 levy trends and some components, a fair bit of detail on the operating referendum, and then if we have time, we can get into some of the shifts and how those work. So I thought, without further ado, I'd just jump in, Madam Chair. So what we're looking at here is the beginning of a trend chart of the overall K-12 levies. This is why the K-12 bill comes to this committee at least every biennium, sometimes twice a biennium, to monitor the overall levy picture in the K-12 bill. Most of the spending committees get aid targets in accordance with the overall general fund allocation that's given to that committee. The K-12 committee also gets a levy target, how much the levies can grow or are required to decline, or in most cases are flat over the course of the biennium or on an annual basis. And these overall numbers represent what we tend to be working with. So prior to the big plan, that would be fiscal 02. We talk about fiscal 01 being the year the big plan was passed, but really the levies didn't become effective. The changes for that year didn't become effective until 2003. So you can see they went from the $1.9 billion number down to $986 million. So a pretty substantial drop, and that's the elimination of the general education levy. And then if you lay on top of that what has happened subsequent, we have a fair bit of levy growth. So and we'll talk about some of the components of that in a moment, but we were just below $2 billion in overall K-12 levies, and we surpassed that or added those levies back in the fiscal 2010 timeframe. So, Madam Chair and members, that just gives you a little bit of history about the overall size of the K-12 levies over time. The next logical step is to break them apart a little bit, and that this chart is a little bit confusing, but I kind of want to emphasize on a few lines because I think it's useful. The diamond is the overall general education program. So that's the blue line that starts at the top on the left side and then drops. That's the that's the elimination of the general education levy. The credits that also were eliminated at the same time is that triangle that goes from the bottom, and they meet together because they both were relatively, the credits weren't completely eliminated, but pretty close. I think it's also useful to take a look at the squares, the operating referendum and capital projects levy. These are the levies that have to be approved on a by the voters. And you'll see when we look at some of the the data in more detail, that the operating referendum has been where most of that growth has occurred. You can see it's on a pretty healthy incline from its low point in 2003. And we'll get into more detail on that in a moment. So the operating referendum has been where the schools have added revenue over the last decade or so.
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nauman, could you tell me what's in the general education levy in, you know, 5 through what's,
sure.
What's in that?
We talked about that, Senator Skoy and Madam Chair, in response to the Chair's question last week. Although in the 2002 timeframe, that was the general education levy. Mm-hmm. And then it went down to zero, and it stayed there for about 2 years. And then as part of the budget balancing in 2003, as well as 2005, the operating capital, transition revenue lines, and equity lines all received, and those are all components of general education. We backed out state aid as part of a policy initiative. We, as the legislature, backed out state aid and equalized it. So it's a blend of both aid and levy on those revenue lines. And then subsequent to, about the 2005, check me on this, I think it was about 2007, the QCOMP program also has a blend of state aid and levy, and that's in general education as well. So then as properties values grow over time, those levies have also grown over time.
Yes. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nauman, are those levied on the net tax capacity or the market value, and is that consistent with the previous general ed levy?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, great question. The general education levy was on ANTC. The transition levy is on referendum market value. The QCOMP is on ANTC. The equity levy is on referendum market value, and the operating capital is on ANTC. So there's a blend there. And I think that part of the reason for that was that when some of those levies were passed, they were originally slated to be rolled in to the operating referendum, and then the legislature a couple years later eliminated that roll-in.
Senator Skoy.
And this will be the last point. So, I mean, well, they're not exactly the same as the old general ed levy because they're equalized differently, and they're on different properties.
Mr.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, absolutely, they're different components. They're imposed differently. What this chart is designed to show, and I wouldn't want to characterize it as the same as the old gen ed levy by any means. Instead, it's because they fall under the broad rubric of what general education is, they show up on this chart as that. But I would, policy-wise, draw a line at 2003 or so to say general education levies were different at a prior point.
And Madam Chair, the point I wanted to make is that all education property tax levies are not the same because they're equalized differently and they fall on different properties differently depending on whether they're on ANTC or market value. So you have kind of, it's not all one number just because it's a property tax levy. Different people are paying it across the state.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, to Senator Skoy's point, I've got a question. You know, at our last meeting, we had a bill in front of us to eliminate the statewide property tax levy, and included in that was seasonal recreational property. And you know, my understanding as I researched this and I asked the question, you know, why did we have the seasonal recreational in there? Was that they were exempt from school operating levies, or was it all school levies? And how does that, if that was the trade-off that, you know, they didn't have a vote and we were going to exempt them from these levies, how does that get set back if we eliminate the statewide levy?
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, that's a great question as well. It does take you a little bit back to that conversation that we had last week about the 2001 reform. Several of these levies that I just mentioned in response to Senator Skoy's question, the referendum market value levies, were imposed shortly after that time frame. And in 2001, decisions were made that excluded, that essentially created that statewide business tax at the same time that that the overall tax base for some of the K-12 levies was being adjusted. And it's a policy choice open for your consideration in terms of how you would move forward if you chose to go that route and eliminate the statewide general levy.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, is there a way we could get a list of, you know, because rental property, I mean, seasonal recreational exempt, rental property isn't exempt. Can we get a list of what's exempt from these different levies? I mean, or different classifications that are exempt?
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, I think that would very easily be doable. I think the tax staff would probably be the best place to do that. What I can tell you pretty quickly is that the K-12 levies are largely all ANTC with a few exceptions. The two that I mentioned to Senator Scoy, and then the third, the big enchilada, is the operating referendum. That's also on referendum market value, so it would be excluded from that. And the debate in 2001, of course, was about whether, in part, was whether the seasonal property ought to be included for the operating referendum for a simple matter that they weren't voters in the district, and that tended to hold some sway at the time.
Senator Rust.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Nauman, we also heard from a lot of the rural counties and rural school districts that in their areas, the seasonal rec property functioned like CI property did for their revenues, and so then the argument became, well, if from the cabin owners, if we are, if you think of us like the CI property, then. And that's the base we provide, then we want to be treated like the CI property. Unlike Senator Howe, unlike the rental property, even though there's the same issue of voting that we chose not to allow. But in some jurisdictions, the seasonal rec property is a huge amount of market value that where they may have very little CI property.
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, could I add one more thing to that? I think then part of the rationale for the statewide business tax was that everybody should be contributing to education at some level, and so they're going to contribute to this fund, and originally it was dedicated exclusively to education, I believe.
Right. And Madam Chair, and by spreading it all over the state, it was not that the argument was made, rightly or wrongly, but the argument was made that CI property or cabin property in any one jurisdiction wasn't going to have to bear an undue burden, and instead support for education was going to be from those two property classifications was going to be statewide, and then go into the the general formulas, and in a sense that it's a fiscal disparities attitude once again that drove that, but it didn't take too long for us to nullify the fact that the original intent was to go directly into the education formulas. That lasted a New York minute.
Could I add one
Senator
more thing?
Senator Scoy.
And committee members, the other thing that happened with some of that money that the statewide business tax was raising is it went back to these school districts in the form of equalization.
Exactly.
Because the state had taken part of their property values away that they would levy to do things with. So they put equalization money back into those districts to help them pay for their buildings, et cetera. So if we're going to undo the statewide business property tax, we're going to have to figure out funding, well, and that's the cost, to pay for that equalization that helps those districts, or else we're going to have to put them back into their property tax base so that they can levy on it, either one or the other.
Well, Senator Scoy, on that part, I respectfully disagree. I think it's not dedicated now, which is Senator Rust's point. It's not dedicated. It goes just into our general fund. I'm not saying we should cut state equalization aid. What I'm saying is we need to reprioritize how we spend our general fund. And I'm not saying we should cut school district funding. I'm not knowledgeable enough about what's happening with school funding to say that. But I do think that this, the repeal of the statewide business property tax, has to be a number one priority. And maybe you don't see it the same, but I know that the governor says the 168,000 Minnesotans that are unemployed has to be our top priority. He agrees with that. And I think that the repeal of the statewide business property tax is the best way to help in local communities, not just here in the Twin Cities, but across the state, get that economic activity in these small towns that we need. So I guess the only part I disagree with you about, respectfully, is that we can't reprioritize our general fund and that somehow that $800 million every year is going to pay for schools. I don't believe that that's really happening in our general fund budget. I think it just goes into the overall list of expenditures that get funded every biennium.
Well, Madam Chair, obviously when the number is smaller than the overall general fund is, that could be the way it is construed. But, you know, some school districts have skyscrapers downtown for their property tax base, and some school districts have cabins. And if the state is going to take away their ability to levy on those cabins for their buildings, they're going to have to replace that with some kind of equalization aid. If you're going to not tax those cabins on the statewide business tax, you should put them back into the school district so that they can be levied against. That's the way that works. And you also, you're going to have to consider what happens to the CI in those jurisdictions. You probably should put some of that back in to the school district so they can levy against it, because that's what they have for their property tax base.
Senator Squire, I don't disagree about that, that we should be looking at what authority the local school districts, cities, counties, municipalities have within their property tax structure. But I think we should get out of that business.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Squire,
I don't know how you get the state out of the education finance business. It's in the Constitution that we provide general and uniform education. I don't know.
Senator Squire, that's not what
that.
I said at all. I said the state should get out of the business property tax business. Mr. Nauman.
So, Madam Chair, excuse me, members, I'll move on to the next slide. This slide begins to take a look in more detail at the operating referendum. Again, this is the occasion when a school district asks the voters to increase their property tax levies for operating costs of the school district. Is that question that you've been confronted on the ballot. We're not talking about purchasing buildings here. We're just talking about operating costs. And back in 1986, which is the data that I have available at this point, there were 47.1% of the school districts with an operating referendum of some form. We reached a bit of a high point in 2002, and these are fiscal years, at 89.2%, and then we had a little bit of a gully. That was the buyout of $415 off the referendum, moving it onto the formula, the so-called 415 transfer. That created a bit of a drop, and then we hit a little bit of a high point at 90.2, and then it looks like we have a little bit of a gully at 88.1% in 2013. I'd suggest to you that's probably a year in progress, because school districts have a couple of years to renew levies, and some that chose not to do it last time might be doing it this time. So this is based on forecast.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, on that point, I mean, the difference between 90.2 and 88 is like 4, 5, 10 school districts. And if so, is that when you say they fell off, it means their old one ended in 2012 and they have not yet passed a new one to continue, but it's still in effect?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, to amplify that point, the way that we do the forecasting on the operating referendum is imprecise at best, but the precise part is that we know which school districts have referenda that are phased out, and we don't assume in the forecast on a specific district basis which ones are going to we don't assume an automatic renewal. There has to be an active vote for that before it shows up in these data.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Marty.
In other words, next year, if you update this chart, it might be at 90.2 again,
yeah,
realistically.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I guess what I'm suggesting is that for that last year, I wouldn't put a huge amount of stock in the fact that there's a bit of a decline.
Thank you.
So then, I'll mention this. I actually kind of already talked about it. The Governor Ventura big plan is the Gully in 2003. We also did something called the Bowerly Amendment. It was an initiative that came out of the House, named for a former representative who authored it, who did the same kind of thing, moving dollars off the referendum. So those are the two gullies.
Mr. Nauman, it looks to me like these school districts all passed referendums immediately after the big plan. They went right back up, and it seems to me like we got the worst of both worlds. We ended up with the business property tax, and we also got these referendums that raised local property tax dollars to pay for schools.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm going to talk about that in a subsequent chart because I think that some of the data will bear that out as we look at the overall questions and some of the revenue that's out there. Certainly one of the policy choices that occurs when you move money off the referendum and put it on the formula is, do you adjust the overall cap or downward? And we did adjust the cap down a little bit, but not for the total amount that got moved over. So in some respects, there were some districts that were at the cap level that had a levy opportunity. And I'm not judging that. I'm just saying that they could, and other districts that were way beneath the cap that still had levy that got transferred, had the same opportunity to go out and ask their voters with and legitimately say, your operating referendum will not be any larger if you approve this than it would be in the prior year. And that's but for the fact that we moved MIP levy over. So, and I'm not suggesting that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that that's what happened.
Mr. Nauman, are you saying that there was a window of opportunity where there was no cap?
Madam Chair, no. I am not suggesting there was no cap. But if you think about a district that is at the operating referendum cap and then you move $415 off and put it on the formula allowance, which was part of what was done during the big plan, and you adjust the cap for, say, maybe $200 of that. I forget exactly how much we did adjust. That balance ends up being an opportunity. And again, I'm not valuing that. I'm just suggesting that mathematically there's a way that the districts had an opportunity to impose some additional levy at that point. And say to their districts that they weren't increasing relative to the prior year.
Mr. Nauman, do we know how many did that?
I did at one point, Madam Chair. It's been a few years. We could go back and scrub that data. I can tell you how many actually asked the question. You'll see when we get to it. You may remember in the last election. Let me skip ahead a few slides.
All right.
It might be
easier.
In fact, this is the one. So in 2001, if you look at the proposed question line, actually, before we go too far here, look at 2011. This is the most recent year. There was a lot of conversation last fall about it was the biggest year in terms of questions. And it was, if you only go back less than a decade. If you go back further than that, you'll see there was 207 questions on the ballot in 2001. And that's kind of the dynamic that I'm suggesting was out there. It was a levy opportunity because some of the levies, because there was referendum moved from one side to the other, and districts are pragmatic and they took advantage of that. And I don't mean that badly. I just mean that was part of what happened. So this is the trend. This chart shows proposed questions and past questions. So in 2001, for example, there were 207 questions proposed and 138 were successful. 147 were proposed in the most recent election, and 107 were passed. This shows you that trend over time. And then continuing a little bit with the operating referendum, this shows the percent of operating referendum questions and dollars that were approved by calendar year. So of those that were approved, looking at calendar year 2001 election, 65.7% of the questions were approved, and 39.5% of the money was approved. And of course, this splits by district, but you can see that sort of in 2005, we had a different dynamic where we had 73.6% of the questions that were approved, and but more of the dollars, 75.9%. Madam Chair and members, this is a chart I think that's a little that would be especially interesting for this committee, focusing on about the 1995 time frame. This is the percent of the operating referendum that the percent of the referendum revenue that is aid, and you can see over time that in the 94 or 95 through about 2002 time frame, we were bopping around the mid 30s. And subsequent to that, because the equalizing factors haven't been adjusted over time and the property value in the districts has increased, school districts look wealthier relative to the K-12 formula, and the overall aid has declined as a result. So you can see that the numbers have dropped a little bit as you move forward in time. And that, I think, is a bit of an interesting dynamic to see. It graphically displays what I'm sure all of you are well aware of. Your property values go up, your property taxes go up, and K-12 finance is a bit of a teeter-totter. If you push one side of the aid side of the levy down, then the levy side goes up. So, Madam Chair and members, this brings us to the K-12 shifts, which would be a logical breakpoint if you need to continue with your bills. Otherwise, I can jump in, and this takes us into the intricacies of how the shifts work, and I'm happy to proceed if you would like to do that.
Mr. Nauman, I appreciate your recommendation that we probably close there, but can I just go back to that last slide?
Of course you can.
Going back way before even you, and I know you have a lot of institutional knowledge, was there a time when the state paid for all the school funding before we did all these referendums?
Madam Chair, going back to the founding of the Republic, so to speak, the property tax was the primary vehicle for financing education. And then over time, and there are others that could speak to you more about the history of the Minnesota Miracle, for example, that was an effort to put more of the burden on schools on the sales and income taxes. And we injected more and more state aid, equalized the overall rates that were imposed on property taxes. So each school district, for its largely general education portion of its budget, was imposing a more or less equal rate. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question directly, but certainly there has been a bit of an evolution towards the state aid. The 2001 effort was in part of that. It was a logical continuation of that. However, subsequent to that time, we've gone backwards through some of the policy pressures that we've discussed here.
And on this slide, I'm trying to understand in a layperson's way, about the 30%. I get that 30% of the school district's revenues came from their referendums, local property taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that in 2012, 89 or almost 89% of school districts' funding across the state comes from state aid and the rest comes from?
Madam Chair and members, I want to focus your thinking on with respect to this slide that we're just talking about the operating referendum. We're not talking about the overall K-12 formula. But if you consider the operating referendum a useful tool, and we've seen charts that display data that districts are increasingly relying on the act of asking their voters for additional revenue through that process, it might be a useful question. It might be useful to know that the percentages over time have been whittled away through the growth in property tax and the holding constant equalizing factor. So I want to emphasize quickly that this is not the overall state, all the money that we give to school districts. It's just that portion of equalization on the operating referendum that this chart speaks to.
All right, so we've got the state aid, which is the probably the bigger share. You've got the local property tax levy, and then on top of that, you've got these operating referendums that school districts are using to pay for regular operating expenses. We're not talking about capital projects or anything like that. We are talking solely about what they're using day-to-day to pay for their operating expenses.
Indeed, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Members' questions, Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, so is this figured into the formula then? I mean, you're looking at this as a percent of their revenue, but is a individual district's operating revenue, operating referendum figured in to the equalization at all?
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, you've blended a few topics there, so I maybe unpack this a little bit. The overall basic formula is a separate calculation from the operating referendum. When a school district, let's say, I don't know, let's pick one out of the blue, Red Wing, goes to the voters and asks for an increase in the operating referendum, the conversation that occurs locally is, here's how much this referendum will increase the taxes on your home worth $100,000. I'm sure you've all heard that conversation occurring locally. What they're doing is calculating for as far out as we can project, which is maybe 4 years. It's not super deep into the details. How much the blend of state aid that the state will kick in, because if the voters approve it, there's both an aid component and a levy component together, which equal the overall amount of revenue that a district is going to receive if that question receives a yes vote. So there, it's already figured into the math in the local conversation when they say, here's how much it will be for a local home.
Madam Chair,
Senator Howe.
I need a little clarification on that.
Certainly.
The question is if it passes, if that local referendum passes, in the future, does the state look at that and say, well, you're getting X amount here, and so we're going to adjust your equalization? Or is this just an add-on to whatever equalization they get?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair and Senator Howe, in some respects, I'd pose that question to you. Do you look at it that way? And I'm not trying to be cagey about that, but that's a policy choice, right? The level of equalization, that line on that hypothetical example that we looked at a few weeks ago, is a policy choice. And that where you set that line, where the equalizing factor is, dictates how much of the operating referendum, if we're looking at that one, and we're talking about that now, how much of it is, how much of the overall revenue in an operating referendum for a particular district comes in state aid, and how much of it comes in property tax levy. If you adjust those equalizing factors, that's a policy lever that's available to both this committee and the K-12 committee. You can increase the state aid and reduce the property taxes.
This may be where we began. I mean, where the question is, these school districts don't have the same ability across the state to pass an operating referendum.
And, Madam Chair, that's a good point to wrestle with, because I've aggregated these data up to a statewide level. It's certainly possible for us to chunk out some data on this on a district-by-district level, and that's something, if you have an interest, we'd be pleased to do, that would allow you to see, okay, what are those rates over a variety of districts?
Mr. Nauman, is this where the caps come in also?
Well, the caps certainly apply to the operating referendum, but in some respects, that's a different policy question. I tend to think about the caps as a previous legislature's attempt to wrestle with the fairness question about should you be allowing those districts that have a sizably larger property tax base per kid to generate lots more dollars for their kids and then generate maybe a disparate level of financial support for their kids relative to kids that don't come from districts that have that kind of support. This chart deals with then sort of is the state kicking in the dollars or are the locals paying for it?
Mr. Nauman, does the cap apply to the levy or does the cap apply to the referendum, I guess is a better question.
Madam Chair, the caps apply to the operating referendum revenue. So if you take a look at your, let's look at the 2012 number at 9.3. That's 9.3% of the overall revenue. So the difference would be maybe 91% more in levy. The caps would apply to that total amount.
Madam Sounds
so in Minnetonka's, I'm sorry, Senator Scoy, I'll get right back to you, but Mr. Nauman, if you remember, we talked at the very first meeting about Norwood Young America and Minnetonka. Minnetonka would like us to lift the cap is what's on their sheet. And I'm trying to understand what exactly would that mean in that district, because I know that Norwood Young America is challenged in order to find any ability to pass an operating referendum. They've done it because their community is very supportive, but they are challenged with the market values in that community. So when a Minnetonka comes to me and says, we want to raise the cap, what exactly are they asking us to do?
It's a great question, Madam Chair. What Minnetonka would be asking you at that point is, we want the ability to generate more revenue off the operating referendum. In a district like Minnetonka, doesn't have a lot of kids that qualify for free and reduced lunch or come from a sparse district. It is one of the revenue lines that they depend on pretty heavily to finance their overall education. So what they're asking for is, we want the ability to generate more revenue off of the operating referendum. And they see the cap puts a limit on how far the Minnetonka School District can go, because their voters have approved referendum up to that cap, and they would like to generate more. When you speak about Norwood Young America, they're looking at a different dynamic. They're pretty substantially underneath the cap, so for them that's a policy question that they're not thinking terribly hard about. They're looking at different vehicles to generate revenue.
So then the caps are keeping these percentages they are having some impact on these percentages.
Well, Madam Chair, in most cases when you look at a Minnetonka, because these are statewide numbers, most of their referendum is going to be all on the levy. So what we're talking, and that's because the equalization tends to not be, they tend to be wealthier than the formulas would generate equalization for them. So what they're talking about is, we want overall revenue. Other districts are saying, we'd like to have more equalization because we're underneath the cap. We'd like to have more equalization to bring the tax price down so that we can then go to our voters and say, it's a little bit cheaper if you pass this referendum, which would allow us to get more revenue. It's a complicated balancing act. Those at the top, their levy rates are actually lower relative to some of those that are, in fact, getting equalization because of some of the interplay of these formulas.
Well, I think it might help us to have a couple of examples that we talk about. I don't know what other members think, but I'd sure like to see how these caps impact the schools and how they raise funds. Senator Michelle.
Well, Madam Chair, you're a Minnetonka grad.
I am.
And I've heard Minnetonka folks describe it this way, that one of the impacts of those caps are that the state is grounding the high flyers. In other words, districts that are doing well and want to do better, communities that are doing well and want to do even better, communities that are ready to pay more in property taxes for schools are prohibited from doing so. It's an irony, at least.
I agree, and I'm trying to figure out, are we really helping everybody with these caps, or are we hurting some districts? And I'm trying to understand why all these school districts are in such different shape when it comes to raising. I mean, it seems like there's so much complexity that there is no rule. There is no, it's just so different district by district statewide. And, you know, by the way, go Skippers. I mean, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I guess the way to look at it is, we have the decision to make. Do we want to say you can raise as much as you can raise locally, which the Minnetonkas and others could do, and for the same tax rate in Minnetonka as Norwood Young America, they're going to raise a heck of a lot more money. And so the question is, do we want to say, well, if a district has the ability to raise the money, they can raise unlimited amounts. Then you get to the questions of the equity between districts, which is the other balancing part, which is why we have the caps at the top end. And obviously those districts would like to remove the caps. I've had some of those districts, and they would like to get rid of the caps. But then the other districts, the Norwood Young Americas, are saying, look, those folks have unlimited amounts to spend, and we're struggling to get even this basic amount. So, but Minnetonka is not going to be getting the equalization for the levy. they're not getting any of that, I assume.
Well, now you can see my confusion, you know, talking to the superintendent in Norwood Young America and the superintendent in Minnetonka. It's happening right there in the middle of my district, that conversation. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not going to get into the uniform part of education again, but I do want to carry on a little bit with what Senator Howe said. What happens in some of these school districts that get equalization aid is when they go out for their levy, they explain to their voters that we're going to do a $200, or I'll do a $100 per pupil levy. That's the way it's explained to the voter. The locals are going to pay $50 of it, and the state is going to pay $50 through equalization. Now, that could be 60-40 or 70-30 or whatever, but they explain it as if you're going to get $30 of state aid if you're willing to vote for $70 of your own money going into schools. That's what happens. The question I have for Mr. Nauman, and I should know this, but I can't remember, what happens when either policy changes at the state or property values locally change enough to move that equalizing number around through the period of the levy? Does the number move, or are they fixed on what they've told their voters the year that they vote?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, that's a great question. The number moves. That computation every year. So I think it's smart for folks that are posing that question to say, here's what we think we're going to generate. We're not promising a 50-50. The legislature has established a equalizing factor in law as a hard number, and the variable is the change in the property tax base. So if a school district begins to look wealthier relative to the formulas, and these data tend to show that, then there's less equalization aid. That's just how the math works. That's part of what we do in our offices is go back and make those computations.
So it's like the LGA formula. It automatically adjusts every year unless we do something about it because circumstances change in communities.
Madam Chair, the point is that the equalizing factor has been relatively constant. As the property tax base increases, there's less state aid and generating less dollars that we have to appropriate in the general education appropriation line as a result. That occurs in the operating referendum. It occurs in the other levies that I mentioned to you, Senator Scoy, about the in general education. But I think it's a little bit more acute in terms of folks' awareness on the operating referendum for the simple fact that there's that question that gets asked every 7 to 10 years.
And, Madam Chair, could just
Senator
one quick.
Senator Scoy.
When on that graph did the voter approved part of the referendum come into being, or has it always been there?
Madam Chair and members, I believe it's off this graph. That was part, the voter approval began concurrent with the. I may have this history wrong, Senator Scoy, but I believe it occurred initially with the Minnesota Miracle in the early 70s. But the equalization came on in the early 90s, which is why this chart shows what we have here.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Nauman? Thank you so much. I do hope that you'll come back, and I'll ask Ms. Cadoon to schedule your next visit and our next lesson on school funding. It's very informative. I'm so grateful for you,
Madam
and for
Chair,
the conversation we're having here.
I'm pleased to come anytime you want to have me. I said before it's always a little daunting to come here, but I'm getting a little more comfortable with it. I'll mention to members that we have included some charts on the K-12 shifts. That is an important topic, especially the property tax recognition shift. So if that's something you want to get into at a future time, we'd be happy to do that as well.
Thank you so
Madam
much.
Chair, thank you very much.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank you for the information that you provided me, that interactive where you could plug in the school district and see the state aid changes. So thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, I hope that's useful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And members, we do have a quorum here. I believe Senator Dibble is somewhere in the room. Senator Dibble, are you here? Okay. Members, we do have a quorum present, and we are going to take a couple of bills up today that I do hope to act on. Senate File 1636, Senator DeCryf and his guests have been very patient with us this morning, and we are now going to take up his bill, the sales and use tax modification for rent and lease to own vehicles. Senator DeCryf, is this your first time in the tax committee? Are you experienced at this?
Good morning, Madam Chair, and I think it is the first time I've been in tax committee. So I appreciate you hearing this bill.
Well, we'll be extra nice to you this morning then, Senator DeCray.
I appreciate that. That doesn't always happen the first time when you get in a
first
committee
time,
for the first time.
First time you get a pass. Go ahead, Senator.
Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Senate File 1636, which is a rent-to-own, lease-to-own sales tax change. Madam Chair, would you like me just to go into explaining?
Go right ahead and explain your purpose of the bill and what it accomplishes.
I'll go for it. We currently have a Minnesota-based business that can conduct business in 46 other states, except because of our tax law in Minnesota, cannot operate here. Current law states, for new and used vehicle leases, excluding vehicles with a manufacturer's gross vehicle rate greater than 10,000 pounds, the sales tax rate of 6.875% is required to be paid up front on the total lease price. Prior to 2005, the tax was paid on each monthly payment. Many of the customers of Northland Auto Leasing around the country are low to middle income and don't have very good credit rating. Many of them will purchase a low-priced vehicle, and this law change will allow them to own a better quality vehicle, or at least be driving a better quality vehicle. When the purchaser goes to the deputy registrar to purchase license and to register the car, they are required to pay sales tax. There is no proof necessary to show what was actually paid for the vehicle, and I know people who have reported a sale much less than the actual purchase price. In this case, the state does not receive the proper sales tax that the state has coming on that sale. Another symptom of many of these folks purchasing inexpensive cars is some of them are driving without insurance. The proposed law change would provide an exemption to the upfront payment of the total sales tax for rent-to-own and lease-to-own used vehicles, where the lessee may purchase or return the vehicle at any time for any reason without penalty. The sales tax would be imposed on the down payment and on each periodic lease payment. This company also requires their customers to carry liability and physical damage insurance on their car, which is monitored closely. This is a great benefit to Minnesota to have more people insured on our roadways. This law change will allow this lower to middle income group to lease a car and walk away from it if their life conditions change, either for the better or the worse, without penalty. This law change will also allow a successful Minnesota-based company to do business in their home state. Now, what a novel idea.
Senator DeCray, thank you. You have testifiers here to talk about what's happening in the industry.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to introduce Alan Lynch. He's the CEO of Northland Auto.
Mr. Lynch, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I did a comparison here just to show you what if we did over a three-year period here, if we did a number of cars we showed on here we could do is with our dealers was 756 cars over that three-year period.
Say, Madam Chair, if I could, there's a handout I think that you have in your packets.
We do have it, members. It's in your packet, and it states it's rent-to-own and lease-to-own tax versus current Minnesota tax analysis at the top. Senator, or Mr. Lynch, proceed.
Yeah. One of the things that we'd like to understand is that with our system here, The type of customer that we're talking about here, the more impoverished customer, can't get financing any place to buy a car. So they're forced onto the street to buy $500 to $1,500 cars. That's just a fact of life in the auto industry or in the car business. And what that does is we know that those cars are all 10 years old and older. They're junk cars, not much left of them anymore. So they have a lot of breakdowns and problems that these people don't need. But that's all they can afford to buy. And so they buy those on the street, and they pay the $10 worth of taxes to the state of Minnesota for those cars. This gives them a chance to buy a better car. If we could collect the tax, if we can collect the tax on a monthly basis like almost all the other states in the United States do, it would give these people a chance to do that. If it stays the way it is, the problem is those customers can't afford to pay the tax up front. plus to pay enough money so that the dealer can get the deal done for them on an upfront basis. They just don't have that kind of money, and they can't seem to save that kind of money. That's the facts of life. And so out of all the states that we do business in, Minnesota is one of our poorest states in the United States for our program. I gave an example on the bottom here of the state of Louisiana. Last year in the state of Louisiana, we had 11,500 cars that were on this system. The state of Louisiana collected $4,588,000 worth of taxes on a monthly basis last year. The state of Minnesota collected approximately $115,000 in comparison. That's a sad comparison. We're losing a lot of tax money, number one. Plus, we're hurting these people that can't afford to buy, get financing for a car. This helps them both ways. The reason we put in the, I asked to have put in a bill where it has to be a contract where the customer has the right to bring that car back anytime they want for any reason without any penalties on there. And the reason for that is simple. Over the way we have the system is set up now and designed in the United States with what we call the buy here, pay here market, that we have a 30% repossession rate in the United States on that marketplace with that type of customer. That hurts the customer's credit, makes it even tougher for them to get another car. This takes all that away. With this lease and the right to return, if they run into financial difficulty of anything, they can bring the car right back and walk away with no problems whatsoever and no more bad marks on their credit. So that's why we're asking for the tax to be changed so these people can afford to pay the tax on a monthly basis. They cannot afford to pay $600 up front for the taxes. It just doesn't work. So thank you very much, folks. And
Mr. Chairman?
I want to check in quickly with Senator Kreif. We have a question here, and I think you have another witness that you want to have some remarks.
Do
you
want?
Senator Kreif, what would be your preference? Want to have your other witness?
We could take a question for Mr. Lynch if
Senator
you prefer.
Thank
Mr.
Senator
Chairman, my question is for the department, not for the
witness. Okay, the department.
So I can wait.
You want to put him on notice, Senator Rest?
Certainly.
Give him a heads up. Do you see who you want to?
Whoever is here.
If
but late, but can wait.
All right, we need the department warming up in the bullpen. Senator Kreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to introduce Darren Hartzell. He is the finance coordinator with Tom Cadillac Honda in Rochester, Minnesota.
Mr. Hartzell, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. I have the privilege of working with these customers face-to-face at the dealership when they come in and sit down and meet with us. The opportunity that this provides for them is several-fold. Perception is a big thing in our society, and for them, to be allowed the opportunity to have a much better-looking, more reliable vehicle allows them to get back to work, allows them to go to a job interview in these different places in a much better situation. Statistically for us, during that February-March time of the year, we're going to statistically do several of these leases every year, only because they wait all year to get that tax refund. That's the money that they're afforded to do that. Throughout the course of the year, that dwindles down greatly in not being able to come up with that required money up front. The second part of that being the freedom that this allows them to be in. In many of these consumer situations, they may have been on unemployment, they may have lost jobs, medical issues, many different reasons that have led them to where they're at. However, this doesn't add another stress to their life for them. Okay, they get the vehicle lease started. They may have it for 6 months. They may have it for a year. Their life changes, they are got a job, they lost a job again, whatever the situation may be, and if they've fallen on those times, they come back, they're able to return that vehicle with no further commitment to the situation, simply being it's left on a very positive note with the consumer at that point. 6 months later, things change, they can come back, and they can start over again. So it greatly makes a very positive experience with the consumer and provides them a good opportunity. So. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Ms. Von Mosch, I wonder if you could pull up a chair, and I'm anticipating that you might be able to address Senator Rest's question, even though we haven't even heard it yet. So,
Mr. Chair, while she comes up.
Ms. McQuay, thank you.
I'll just walk through the revenue estimate for the committee. By changing the definition of a rent-to-own from a lease to a sales tax, the general fund is being increased by $25,000 in fiscal year 13, $55,000 in 14, and $85,000 in 15. There is an effect also on the Natural Resource and Arts Fund of $5 million or $5,000 a year reduction. When the lease changes from the lease to the rent to own, there's a statute in law that requires lease purchases the funding from or the revenue from that to go into the Greater Minnesota Transit account and the County State Highway Fund. And so when the lease transfers to just a sales tax on a monthly basis instead of the upfront payment, there is a reduction to the Greater Minnesota Transit account and the County State Aid Highway Fund of, in the first year, $70,000 for both of those funds, $80,000 in the subsequent year, and then $85,000 in fiscal year 2015.
Thank you, Ms. McQuay. Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that in the...
You are first, Senator Rest, but I thought Senator Dibble might be speaking to Ms. McQuay's testimony and presentation.
Senator Rest might be, too.
Okay.
Those things tend to catch her eye, too.
Let's go to Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Maj, explain the why that last sentence in the second paragraph is the case. I need to understand that. And then secondly, I want to make sure that this is not a challenge to streamline at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the last sentence in the second paragraph is related to the provision that is in current law, which specifies that all of the upfront taxes paid are distributed, as Ms. McQuay said, to the general to the Greater Minnesota Transit account and the County State Aid Highway Fund. By making the payment an upfront payment, it avoids that provision in statute, and therefore it means that the funds are basically they're going into the general fund rather than being transferred.
Mr. Chairman, the streamline issue is not an issue, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I don't believe so, but I would want to check with the department on that, and I can check on that.
And then I have just a follow-up to that.
Senator
Mr.
Rest.
Chairman, thank you very much. Ms. Von Mosch, are there other instances in which the sales tax is avoided by the distribution of the sales tax is avoided by the pro rata?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, in relation to the transportation funds, you mean?
Are there any instances in the law where making a monthly payment as opposed to an upfront payment, which would send the upfront payment, would distribute it to those various funds? Are there other instances, or is this unique?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest,
Zamash.
I am not aware of any others, but I'd want to double check on that and get back to you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Von Mosch, that would be of interest to me. I'm not opposed to this proposal as such, but I certainly would like to know if it happens somewhere else, and then secondly, whether it is a challenge to streamline. I don't think so, but I certainly would be interested in answering that question, both those questions, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'll get back to the committee with responses to those questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Von Mosch. I think we might have a few questions still for you. Let me go to Senator DeKreif, and then I'll come this way. Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I might try to answer your question because it takes just a bit to understand what this is doing. What this is doing is it's kind of leasing these vehicles on a monthly basis.
I get that.
Which makes it a new sale each month. Because at the end of July, if they drop it off at the dealership and they say, I don't want it anymore, the deal's done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's a unique situation that we're trying to create here to make sure that these people that are already in dire straits, some of them, can avoid a situation where they're hurt even more. So that's why I think this is something of a unique situation.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested to make sure it stays unique as opposed to others that might come and say, aha, we can avoid paying our transportation sales tax things here. And I would be very opposed if this set some sort of precedent in that regard. I understand the motivation to help these customers and to have them be able to have safe cars on the road. I think that's great and not have to drive junkers. Although I don't accept the notion that because a car is 10 years old that it's a piece of junk. Mine is 11 years old. I have 170,000 miles on it, and it runs just fine.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it all depends on how hard you drive your car. I'm guessing you're not putting it up on two wheels around corners, Senator Rest.
I don't think you've ridden with me.
then you change your oil every 3,000 miles, I guess. picking up on that last point that Senator Rest made, either to Ms. Von Mosch or Ms. Quay, can we overcome this effect of having to deposit those dollars in the general fund versus the Trunk Highway Fund, then distributing it to Greater Minnesota Transit and the county state aid formula? I mean, can we just fix that? I'm not necessarily opposed to this. Although I reserve the right to understand it a little better, but on its face, I'm not opposed to this proposal. $70,000, shorted from Greater Minnesota Transit doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think about how much Greater Minnesota Transit actually receives, that is a lot. Greater Minnesota Transit does run lean and mean on very few state dollars, and $70,000, I think, would be noticed. So can we overcome that statutorily? Can we figure out how to solve that problem?
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think we could write language that would direct sales from this type of lease arrangement to go into those funds. However, there would still be a net reduction to those funds because the money generated annually off the sales tax is less than that of the upfront cost. So you would still see a net reduction of $120,000 a year. But the increase, instead of going to the general fund, could be redirected to the transportation funds.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. So I still remain concerned, although a glimmer of hope. of course, not necessarily my fight, although I'm a one Minnesota kind of guy, but I would hope that the greater Minnesota folks would take some interest and the folks who are interested in county state aid. Take an interest in this issue.
And Senator Dibble, on that point, the chair has reminded me that the path that this bill would take would be to go from here to transportation and then back here, which I think means you've got two or three more shots at it.
Guessing, Mr. Chair, I won't be the only one who has a keen interest in this issue. And I think Senator Kreif knows the Transportation Committee well. So those are all good friends of ours. So.
Ms. Von Mosch, on the Senator Dibble issue?
Mr. Chair, yes, this is on Senator Dibble's question. If you look at the revenue estimate, you will notice that the amount of money going into the general fund is increasing while the amount of money lost to the transportation funds is decreasing. And in the out years, that would, because it is a timing shift issue, so in the out years, we're not sure. If you follow the same pattern, it would probably take several years to get out there, but eventually it would end up being zero because the shift would be accounted for.
Senator Marty.
Madam, Mr. Chair, Ms. Von Mosch, I guess you started to get at what I was trying to figure out, because I was the first year it's $25,000 in new revenue to one fund and $145,000 loss, and it seems it's still only half as much by the third year out. I was trying to figure out how much of that is timing because we're shifting from the upfront payment to the out payment, and how much of that's loss because if I'm paying upfront for an entire, let's say, I don't know if they normally would do a two-year lease, and instead I'm doing it month by month, and if half the people bail halfway through, you'd only be collecting some. Do you know how much of this is truly a shift of timing of the payment, and how much of it is, I mean, how long people are, how many are bailing out of these kind of leases?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I would want to go back and talk to the people who developed the revenue estimate and ask them that question and see if that can be isolated. I'm not sure of the answer of that to that right now.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, and then the follow-up to that is, I'm just trying to get a sense of what this is doing. It talks about the revenue analysis detail estimate says assumed to be a down payment, $1,600. And maybe this is for Senator DeCry, for the witnesses. If I am interested in one of these cars, you say I can rent, I'm leasing it month by month. Am I still putting down like $1,600 down payment, and then if I pay $200 a month or whatever it ends up being, at the end of 2 months, I may have in effect paid a couple thousand bucks for 2 months if I drop it then. Is there a down payment on all these, or is it truly a month by month kind of rental thing?
Mr. Lynch?
Yes, I could answer that, yes. Yes, there is a what we call an origination fee on all of these. That ranges usually from $800 to $1,000. That would be up front. And we that has to be on there because of the fact that what happens when I started this program 22 years ago in the United States, and the first thing we noticed that when we had no origination fee up front, people would come in and rent a pickup for the weekend, put 2,000 miles on it, or for the week they rented for $85 for a week, paid $85, put 2,000 miles on it, move all their furniture, and bring the pickup back at the end of the week. So that didn't work. So we had to put an origination fee up front on there on the program.
Well, Senator Marty.
On that point real quickly, I understand why you'd have an origination fee. I'm just trying to get a sense of, in the states where you're doing this, you said, hey, they can drop it after a month. Obviously, that's very expensive month, if so.
Yes, that
what's typical? Do they usually keep it a year, 2 years?
Yes, the actually typical is 14 months.
Okay.
In the end of those 14, what brings that average there is a lot of the people will come back and change vehicles with the dealer because they can do that without any extra expense or anything. And most of them can do that for the same payment they're making now. They come back and they may get a car that's a year or two newer than what they've got. Or they have another member of the family and they get a van. All of these things constantly change out there. And since they have the total flexibility and freedom, they can do that constantly whenever they would like. So.
Thank you. Members, let me suggest this, that we are running short of time. Senator Peterson has a bill that he'd like to be heard this morning. This bill, I suggest, go to Transportation Committee, and Senator Michelle would move that we refer this bill to the Transportation Committee. I think, Senator DeCry, if you have the interest of members of this committee, you have my support. This is the kind of bill where good bill vote yes, bad bill vote no. This is a good one, and I think we just have to work through the complexity of it, which is unfortunate. You'd think it'd be a pretty straightforward question, but we always are looking at what happens to the financial impact, and folks are trying to protect funding right now when we're short of funds in some people's view. So with that, Senator Michelle moves that this bill be referred to the Transportation Committee. I will be requesting it back. Hopefully they'll pass it back to us, and then we'll finish this conversation. All those in favor of Senator Michelle's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion is adopted. And Senator DeCry, Mr. Lynch, and I don't have your name here. Let's see. Mr. Hartzell, thank you so much for being here. We hope to see you back shortly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson, Senate File 780, repealing the 2% contractor withholding requirement. Thanks for your patience, Senator Peterson.
Should be
You.
Whenever you're ready.
Yep. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I have a little pad before you today, Senate File 7080. Thanks for the opportunity to share this with you this morning. I do have a brief correction. You might have had an A1 amendment, but then I did get a note saying that we could do this by an oral amendment as well. So if you don't have the A1, I need to implement an oral amendment at this point.
All right. Do we have? I don't. All right. Do you want to read the oral amendment?
Sure. Yep. We'll
let council do that, if that's
okay,
all right.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would be on line 2.19, strike 2011 and insert 2012, and on line 2.23, strike 2011 and insert 2012.
And Senator Michelle would make that motion at this point. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator
Peterson. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill would propose to repeal a provision that was enacted just back in 2008, quite recently, that required contractors to withhold 2% of the payments made to individuals acting as a sole proprietor when they had a payment that was over $600. And this bill, I think, had some unintended consequences. You'll note there on the fiscal note that what was collected in regard to this specific issue was about $500,000. And when this bill went into effect in 2008, it was projected to collect in the neighborhood of $2 million. So you can see it fell way short from what is expected. And I think I'll be able to show you today with support from across the community that this is an issue that deserves to be repealed. And essentially what happened, it motivated these sole proprietorships, these small business persons, to convert their businesses to LLC or limited liability corporations, and was kind of an unintended consequence. And now offers a significant burden to small business people in each one of our communities. With that, I'll ask that I can have some guests come up and speak to this issue.
Ms. Perry.
Good morning, members. My name is Pam Perry. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association Minnesota. We represent the residential construction industry. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, and thank you, Senator Peterson, for bringing this issue forward. The Builders Association of Minnesota in 2007 supported registration of the independent contractors in our industry. The bill was passed. Thank you. The bill was passed and then went to the Department of Labor and Industry for rulemaking to determine how an independent contractor should file and get that exemption certificate. Unfortunately, during the rulemaking process, the Department of Labor and Industry, in our opinion, made it extremely difficult for an independent contractor to get that exemption certificate. In fact, the rulemaking process created a circumstance where an independent contractor, in order to get that exemption certificate, it was more difficult for them to get that exemption certificate than it is for a general contractor to get a license. We fought the department vigorously on the rulemaking process and lost. And as a result, getting an independent contractor exemption certificate became very burdensome for a very small business. At the same time, the legislature passed a 2% requirement requiring a general contractor to withhold 2% on all independent contractors. So a huge migration happened in that following year of sole proprietors becoming LLCs. Because it was difficult to get the exemption certificate, and B, because of the withholding requirement. General contractors felt that it wasn't our responsibility to withhold taxes. We also believe that for our sole proprietors. We also felt that we also are required to file 1099s with the federal IRS. We do that. The information that was being filed is available to the Minnesota Department of Revenue in order to review, and that wasn't being done. So you're asking for all this information. We're providing all the information. but in our opinion, the Department of Revenue nor did the Department of Labor and Industry kind of use that information to drill down into this issue. So we support the repeal. It's not making any sense. You haven't raised any revenue. The Department of Revenue did a report to you in 2010, it was inconclusive. As a matter of fact, I think you spent $12,000 to do the report and collected less than $500,000, or right around $500,000. So we support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I just had a question. Perhaps I got the revenue note that says there's no, that says there's cost, administrative costs or savings. And then the other bill description one talks about $120 million fund impact. I assume that's supposed to be $120,000? Is that
Ms.
the right
McQuay?
Bill?
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, yeah, the revenue estimate does show that there's zero impact. The withholding doesn't change the amount of tax that should be paid, but the fiscal note does show some compliance, and that's what this bill description is. There was some problems with the fiscal note system, and so that MMB was having, this is what they would have signed off on and put into an official fiscal note, but it doesn't look like that. To your point, it is $120,000. It's not $120 million.
And Madam Chair, on the other side, I assume that total savings is actually a total cost because they have to change forms, instructions, and videos, or those are things they're not going to be doing in 2013, if so.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, this is a cost to the department that they would assess this change in legislation. So you're correct in correcting that mistake.
Senator Peterson, I think it makes a lot of sense. Why are we collecting this tax and working on a withholding if it's not really raising a lot of revenue? It defeats the purpose here. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious from Ms. Von Marsh again, the last sentence of saying it could have an impact on compliance. That's a fairly vague statement. I'd like to have a little bit more light on why that's even brought up. So if she could come forward and
Madam Chair.
It could have. Questions for Ms. Von Marsh.
Well, Ms. McQuay, did you have a comment on that? Madam
Chair and Senator Rest, I did see that same comment on the revenue note that it would have an impact on compliance, and so which is why I pushed the fiscal note to include that compliance portion, and that's what that $120,000 is.
Ms. Von Marsh, anything
just
more on
that?
Just
explain it to me a little bit more. Thank you, though.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, Ms. McQuaid is the way, or Ms. McQuaid, the way she summarized it is essentially correct. There would be the fiscal note talks about with the lack of having the 1099 and the withholding withheld in the 1099 miscellaneous reporting, we're using some national reports to do an estimate of what a projected compliance loss in revenue would be. The Department of Revenue did do a study in 2011 based on the filings and the activity in 2009. And we did find what the trend that Ms. Perry was talking about, that the number of people affected by the 2% withholding is greatly diminished from what it was originally estimated to be. The department is working on an updated study that we expect to have out in 2 to 3 weeks that will be looking at tax year 10 and the activity within this area, but there is actually very little being collected in this area, but there is also some compliance issues, and I think when we have the updated study, we'll be able to get a better number on compliance based on some actual audit data that we're still analyzing and we're still looking at.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Von Marsh, that's very helpful.
Mr. Raines, are you here to testify in this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Phil Raines. I'm with Associated Builders and Contractors. We're commercial industrial construction companies, and we'd like to urge your support of this bill. I consider this the lawyers and accountants unemployment bill. We have plenty of full employment bills come forward for those groups. as has been noted already, what happened in this area is contractors had a strong incentive to have all their people move to an LLC because, frankly, with the bidding climate that's out there right now, 2% is often your entire profit margin that you have on a bill. So it just didn't make sense for us to do withholding on it and then get people get their money back at the end of the year. We'd like to see this repealed, make it easier for people to do business, make it easier for accountants. It's a well-intentioned provision. It just hasn't worked out really well.
Thank you. With that, members, the chair would move to lay over without objection. All right, I guess let me start over. The chair lays over without objection. Senate File 780 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Members, that being the business before us, we are going to meet again on Tuesday, February 28th. It's going to be TIF and local day. So Senator Gerlach, Senator Wieger, I'll be here with the Bloomington Mall of America proposal, and Senator Box, Cook or Hospital District. On Wednesday, we'll have Senator Latz's bill and Senator Eaton's bill on TIF and Senator Senjum's bill for Bloomington. With that, members, we are adjourned.